On this episode of What's What, traditional and modern perspectives on death and embracing death as an essential part of life. Warning, this episode contains material that may be disturbing to some listeners and viewers.
All right.
Yo.
So.
Welcome back.
Thanks.
Good to have you.
Yeah, nice to be back.
It's been a while.
Had a little bit of a break.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm excited about today's episode.
Death.
Yeah. I think it's got such a bad rap.
Does have a bad rap.
You know?
Yeah.
It's like, so I guess part of this whole episode's come about because I read a book called Death by Sadhguru. Sadhguru is the guru behind the Isha Yoga Foundation.
Okay.
He's a bit of a celebrity guru kind of dude, a little bit controversial. But I mean, I got his book by accident. I was like staying up in the mountains and I had forgotten a book. And I asked the lady who ran the place, like, hey, do you have any books? Like maybe some guests have left behind. And then she said, oh, this book was given to me by a guest staying here. And it's the only English book I have. And she gave it to me, which was funny because my grandmother is like a follower of Sadhguru. And I've actually been to his Isha Yoga, I wouldn't
ashram.
Call it a ashram, in Coimbatore in India. I was taken there when I was young to go and see. No idea where, I had no idea what I was looking at. But now fitting the pictures back together, I realized that I've been to his place.
Was he there or is he dead?
No, he's still around.
He's still around.
He travels a lot, lectures a lot.
So what is, so you read this book, just titled Death.
Yeah.
And what is, what's the, one of the main themes?
I mean, so he's Indian, so he's following the Indian belief of reincarnation and karma and that trajectory and nirvana. And so his belief is that we are all, everything in the universe can be compared to as like a bubble, okay? And there's two kind of aspects of your bubble, you know, the volume of your bubble, how big is your bubble, and then the thickness of your, the skin of your bubble. And he says the best way to die is to have as big of a bubble as possible with as thin of a skin as possible so that when you pop, you don't create a lot of reverberation.
So there's not a lot of tension and resistance, karmic tension and resistance built up.
So he says through your life, you have the, this is your opportunity to grow your bubble. So you could maybe look at that as like expanding your consciousness and minimizing the amount of tension and friction that you have with other things going on and objects that can bump you. And he says, this is basically the effect of ridding yourself of karma in this life.
It's a great visual. I remember when you told me that a couple months ago, it immediately resonated with me. And I was able to see that, see my own existence in this world as a sort of bubble.
Yeah. And so some people, yeah. And so some people, if you have a very thick skin and a small bubble, if you get bumped, you're more likely to go flying across the metaverse or whatever space we're in.
The cosmic room.
Yeah, the cosmic room. The other thing that he kind of talks about is that death and life, and I think we see this in a lot of Eastern philosophy, that death and life are two faces of the same coin.
Mm-hmm.
And that the way we have, our society's developed now is in a very like fearful idea of death, when in reality, we actually don't know what's on the other side of that and could be really blissful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it could, and the same way that you come into living kind of spontaneously when you're born and you're entering a whole new existence, maybe the same thing, it's just another form of being born into the deathly existence.
Interesting. Yeah, I could dig that. I think what people are afraid of, because I want to talk about this, this is an important part. I think that what people are afraid of is not having the conscious memory of this life. You know, Alan Watts kind of talks about this. He says that the death in itself is like, it's not that big of a deal for the person that's going through it. It's all the attachments that we have, all the memories, all the relationships, all the things that we've accrued through this life that we're going to lose because... Mm-hmm. I mean, it's debatable whether or not you take these memories with you into another life. There have been cases where people seem to remember their previous iterations, their previous incarnations. But for as far as we know, you kind of, this consciousness maybe isn't erased, but you don't have the same connection to it when you're here in this physical body. So when you go into the next iteration, it's kind of like starting anew, even though the maybe the energy is the same. And I think that's what scares people, because we develop so many attachments to our relationships, to our things, to our ideas, to our ego in this world. And to lose that, even if you do believe in reincarnation, to think that.
But it's the only, it's funny because it's like the only thing that is certain for every single human that lives on this planet.
Yeah.
And has ever lived. It's the only certainty, you know, that.
Maybe that's what scares us so much about it.
I don't know. I was young when I decided I wasn't going to be scared of it.
Really?
Yeah. I remember being a child and being like, it happens to everyone. It can't be that bad.
That's awesome, because I was terrified of it. I used to have crippling anxiety about my parents dying. Not me personally. I was okay with the idea of dying, or as okay as I could be. But it was other people dying that I was terrified of, really terrified of it. I've let go of it, though, since I've, you know, been friends with you, and since I've been going on this whole journey here in Bali. It's definitely given me more acceptance, because you know how they are here. There's like, I mean, there. You want to talk about this now? You want to talk about the Balinese stuff?
Yeah, we can start. We're going to talk a little bit about rituals that we've researched in the East, death rituals in the East, and maybe I think compare them to the West.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
So yeah, what do they do here?
Well, so we see it. We see it sometimes. We see a funeral. The word for the ceremony is Nyangban.
It's not Naben.
Naben?
Naben.
No G. Okay, got it.
It's a silent G.
Silent G. So what they do is they'll, if a person dies, in order to save cost,
go ahead. Why don't you take it?
Because
okay, so it's,
but kind of is though.
No, it's because there's certain things that need to be done when a person dies,
right,
and also
right.
depending on what status that person had, there's more commitment that the family needs to make.
Yeah,
and there's certain ceremonies that need to be done, and if they're not done, then you're not giving them a good send off. And then you're putting them at jeopardy in their afterlife. You're not giving your ancestors the reverence that they deserve.
Right. So, but let's put this in a context for people. The reason they do that is because they believe that when your soul or your energy or whatever leaves this body, this physical structure that it's in, that there can be a battle between the evil spirits and the good spirits and the evil spirits.
Oh, I didn't know this.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that
so
they
you
can,
need to send them off in the best possible way.
Yeah. To give them the best chance to make it to whatever the positive side of that is.
Because here there's also a lot of belief that your ancestors influence your life. And if you like, you have a temple for your ancestors and then you go periodically and give offerings. And a lot of the time they're praying to their ancestors because with this belief that they will either help or hinder them.
Right, right.
So this is why. So Naben, it's not everywhere, but there are certain villages in Bali where they have group. It happens actually here in Uluwatu as well. They had a big Naben like last year. They have a group ceremony for a funeral. So what happens is, I think there's like a small ceremony and the body is placed in the ground. And then when it's time for the Naben, the bodies are exhumed and then cremated. And so it's part of Hindu custom to cremate the body. Very different to the West.
Because again, they feel like they've got to eliminate this physical structure in order for the soul or whatever you call it to go into its next existence.
Yeah. And there's even a belief that I read in Sadhguru's book that like, people close to the dead person shouldn't have the dead person's belongings, like shouldn't take their clothes. Like don't, you can give it to a stranger who didn't know them, but the people who are close to that body shouldn't like hang on to the physical attachments, even in terms of belongings.
Why is that?
Because it gives the spirit
something to come back to.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, which makes sense. So another thing they do is they, like you were describing with the graves. So they bury them, and then when it's time for the Naben, the big one where they do multiple people together, partly to save costs.
No, a lot of it is, but it's to save costs, but also be able to pool the resources so that you can ensure that your ancestors get. If you were to do it single-handedly, it would be really hard for every single person in the community to pay their dues. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you pool the resources and have one large ceremony,
you can do it properly.
You can do it properly.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. So another thing they do, because I watched a video of them doing it in a village in Nusa Penida. Nusa Penida is another island right off the coast of Bali. It's still technically part of Bali, but a separate island. Where they, so they did 13 of them. And they put them, depending on the caste that the person was in, they either put them in a lion, an ox, right? Mm-hmm. Like a sarcophagus that's a
temple shaped,
oxen shaped, lion shaped. And they burn it, like Rishi said, but then they actually pull the bones out if they haven't burned completely and crush them. Mm. Have you seen this before? Mm-hmm. Where they crush the bones. Again, this idea that the physical structure needs to be, I don't know if eliminated is the right word, but to be
dissolved from this realm
as much as possible for it to get, again, to give it the best chance, the soul a best chance, mm-hmm. the best chance to ascend, mm-hmm. which is
and
pretty
I think
crazy.
The whole kind of mentality around death, maybe in developing parts of the world, is a much more run-of-the-mill kind of experience.
Well, and there's intentionally a separation.
Yeah.
They want it to be
I remember talking to one of my staff, and she was like, oh, my dad died. And I was like, how old was he? And she was like, 68. And I was like, that's pretty young. She was like, no, that's pretty old in Bali.
Really?
Yeah.
68.
Yeah.
You do see some older people. I don't know how old they are. Maybe they just look older than they actually are. 68, average.
She seemed unsurprised.
Well, I think, okay, so getting to what we were talking about a second ago, there is this very casual attitude that a lot of Indonesians generally, mm-hmm. Balinese specifically, mm-hmm. have towards death, right? I mean, the first dead person I ever saw was when I first moved to Uluwatu. A guy had a motorbike accident. He was just laying. I mean, I'm pretty sure he was dead. He looked like it. And I was just, and the people, you've seen how they are around accidents.
Yeah.
They're just kind of like, yeah, you know, it is what it is. Whereas if you're in the West, you know, they'd be calling an ambulance or be freaking out.
Like taking pictures.
Or they're taking pictures. Yeah. Oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very different attitude.
It's a very, life is in some ways cheap here, but it's not just that. It's not just the fact that life is kind of cheap, right? Because of all the issues that come along with living in a country like Indonesia. But it's also because they do have this belief that it's not the end.
Mm,
this mm-hmm. isn't the end. This is they always talk about it in terms of a transition, a mm-hmm. transformation.
That's true.
You know, this is not a goodbye. It's not or not a goodbye forever. But yeah, you contrast that with because as a Westerner, at first that was kind of shocking to me to see that, to see how casual they were about it and kind of scared me. It was like, well, shit happened kind of on your own, right? Mm. You have a motorbike accident or something. They're not going to be rushing to help you. But then you look at the other side of it and I think about my upbringing being so terrified of death, like we just talked about. That's also not desirable. And that's not a nice way to live.
That actually leaves you, I feel like, with a lot more attachment when it's actually time for when it happens maybe to somebody else or even when it's time for you to go because you've lived in fear of it.
Mm-hmm.
Can be frightening, I think.
And this gets into, you want to talk about the commercialization or that story around embalming specifically. So if you haven't seen Midnight Gospel, it's pretty interesting, trippy.
Very trippy show.
Very trippy, like animated adult animation. And they get into these really deep philosophical discussions with some just like tripped out animation scenes playing out while they're talking about these things. And one of the episodes that we watched was with a mortician. And she's explaining to the host, this kind of like cosmic time world traveler guy who's just going and having these interesting conversations. The mortician is talking to him about the history of embalming in the United States and was saying that during the Civil War, the Northern soldiers who fought and died in the South, their families wanted to see them one last time, but it was such a long distance they had to travel. And then some entrepreneurs figured out that at the time you could put arsenic in them. Arsenic's a preservative.
Yeah.
And you could preserve the body, send them on the train, and then the families would be able to see their loved one who died. So that's how this whole embalming
and
preservation started.
Because like in India and in Hindu belief, like you cremate the body as quickly as possible, pretty much. Like on the day, usually.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Because you, again, don't want to leave this thing hanging around that lets the entity or whatever have something to cling on to. So how does it work? Because I've always, the first dead body I saw was my stepbrother, actually.
Your stepbrother?
Yeah.
Really?
My stepdad's son. And I remember it was in a room and he was embalmed. and he was in the coffin and I couldn't even be in the room.
Was this in, where was this?
Singapore.
In Singapore.
He was cremated later, but he was, maybe he was not embalmed. I don't know. He had makeup on and he was like lying in the, you know, and I remember like peeping in and being like, oh no. And just like running out of the room, sort of. I wasn't even that young. I was like 20, you know, probably 10, no, 5 years ago or something.
That, I mean, that is pretty shocking.
But so how does it work? Because you have in the Western world, you have a wake.
Yeah, in like more Protestant, yeah, more Protestant traditions, you'll have a wake where, yeah, they prepare the body. And what's interesting is that as we're talking about this, I realize East and West kind of does it, that they're at the core of it, they're doing the same thing. They're just going about it in different ways. So yeah, they have a wake and they'll prepare the body, preserving it, yeah, putting, making up, dressing it up. Yeah. So that you will have wakes. I forget what it's called, but you have some where it, open casket basically, or closed casket.
Yeah.
And the idea, I guess, is kind of the same, which is you're preparing the body to go into its next
iteration. But the difference between the East and the West is normally the family will prepare the body.
Right.
In
right.
the East.
Yeah. And this is what that Midnight Gospel episode mm-hmm. was talking about, which was these entrepreneurs that went in and preserved the bodies. And the way she described it was pretty trippy. She was saying that they would do these embalming procedures to the bodies and they would like hang them up like advertisements for the trains. You remember this part? Yeah. I was like, oh my God. So anyway, there was an inherent kind of commercialization.
A middleman kind of came into
yeah.
that process.
I mean, this was, you yeah. know, in the late 1700s in America, you know, where industrialization is, or late 1800s, sorry, not 1700s. So industrialization is right around the corner. You're having this very like strong entrepreneurial spirit mm-hmm. and you've got these guys that are doing this embalming. So what happened after the war is they wanted to maintain their business model and get into what you were saying about the separation. So what they did is they kind of said, well, don't worry about the body. You know, it's the body's dangerous. It's disease. Mm-hmm. It's got to like, we'll take care of it. We're the professionals. So getting to what you're saying, that whereas the family used to prepare that, clean the body, prepare the body for its transition, it was taken over by essentially business interest and people that were selling this embalming fluid and selling the whole process of death in the Western world. So because of that, according to the mortician on the Midnight Gospel, that's part of what created that separation. Whereas in the West, it's not really, it's so taboo to sit there with the body, mm-hmm. right? Like, but it kind of sounds like in India, they want to cremate the body as quickly as possible too.
Cremate, yes, yes. But I think even also in Islam, I know there's a long process behind the preparation of the body and it must be done by the family. And I think the act of doing that before the cremation is already your way of touching the body, washing the body, coming to terms with the fact of what's happened.
Right, right.
And then you cremate and you literally watch it go up into the ether.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how you get your closure. Whereas, I mean, in the West, yeah, there's just a different way of going about it.
But that is important, though, mm-hmm. Very important, the whole process of seeing the body, touching the body, right? Where in the West, you don't do that. Like the family member doesn't do that. That's been outsourced to the morticians, mm-hmm. to those folks.
So you have a wake, and that's normally like a couple days after the death.
Yeah, I think it's like 3 days after the death or something.
And then on the day of the wake, the body is buried?
I don't know, actually. I'm not that steeped in the Western Protestant traditions. I know there's a wake.
Is it different for the Catholics?
Probably a little bit different for the Catholics, I would imagine. I mean, similar in some ways. I actually don't know what the Catholics do. I don't know. My dad was raised Catholic, but he calls himself a recovering Catholic. And I was baptized, but we never went to church. I think you just bat, and I have a very Roman Catholic
name. Maybe just to give you a godparents or something.
Yeah, Michael Christopher Syracuse. But I don't know hardly anything about Catholicism. But I do know that it would not be normal for just a normal family with Christian Catholic roots in America to sit there with the body and prepare the body itself.
Dress it.
Because even the spiritual side of it, I think that they would have a priest come in and do something. That's probably what the tradition is in the Catholic Church, that the priest comes in. Well, I know that. The priest comes in, gives like the, whatever it's called, the final blessing, and then whatever happens after that happens. But
so do you want to be buried or cremated?
Cremated, for sure. My dad always told me that he wants to be cremated and he wants his ashes spread across the Monterey Bay with Van Morrison into the Mystic Plane.
That's achievable.
Yeah, that's totally easy.
It's not like far-fetched.
No, it's not far-fetched at all. But then it was interesting because I was watching this video of the Balinese and the Naben ceremony. Mm-hmm. And after they had crushed the bones, so they cremated the body, any bones that were left, they crushed, and then they put the ash into a coconut.
Yeah.
And then they went out into the ocean and they flushed it out. And I just thought of my dad, and I mean, haven't done this and won't have to do it for a long time, hopefully. But it just seemed, again, kind of these similarities. I think there's an intuitive sense that people have. And it's like, yeah, of course, I'm going to burn the body and I'm going to spread the ashes. Because it gives back to the earth, right? I mean, it's the whole hippie idea.
Maybe just going back,
yeah.
Something else. And also you want to disperse the ashes as much as possible so that you're not giving it something to cling on to again.
Right.
And having that urn in your house is just like this reminder constantly of what happened. And you want to kind of, even for the people living, to be able to shed themselves of the sorrow of it all. Which
it's
is why, like,
point.
Having a gravestone is just like... physical reminder place that you can go back to. It's a bit more of a clinging onto.
The attachment.
But then, again. I mean, it's different. There's two things I want to talk about here. The first one is part of Hindu custom is also that, like, right after the cremation, you need to go home and have a shower, like, and wash yourself. And then even in Bali, like, if somebody close in your family or you participated in a funeral recently, you're not allowed to go to temple and you're not allowed to go to certain celebrations.
So
there is like a dirtiness associated with the procedure, but I wonder where that comes from. I wonder if that's like just as a respect thing, kind of, you know, or is like to the dead, or is it a dirty thing, or, and you don't, I'm trying to think of a Western equivalent.
Well, I think that it's maybe
like
it's
a
mourning, mix of both.
Mourning period, you know?
Yeah. Maybe. I think it's a mix of spiritual, emotional, and maybe practical. It's kind of like what you were describing with the cleaning. Remember you had that lady coming clean physically?
Yeah.
And,
feng shui
and
my house.
Yeah. But she was talking about how when the dirt accumulates, like even that dirt and that grime that can accumulate in the corners of your house, that'll attract the demon energy, so to speak. Maybe that's not exactly how she put it, but that's essentially what she was getting at. That there is a process, a physical process that takes place when somebody dies. You know, the tissues start to break down and it decomposes. And there is something, I'm not going to say dirty or dangerous about it, but that is a different process that's happening than the bodily process that living organisms have.
Yeah.
And we do have to be careful with that. Because in that transition, there are things, whether you label it as disease or some kind of demonic evil energy latching onto that.
And this is why Hindus believe to be vegetarian as well. Mm-hmm. Or like eating a dead animal is bringing that dead energy into your body.
Yeah.
And it's also where the belief comes from.
So can we take a break? We got to do a cool the camera down / commercial break.
Yeah.
And then what do you want to talk about on the other
end? The other thing I wanted to talk about was maybe like ancestor worship.
Cool.
A little bit.
Yeah, I'm down with that.
And then we can
talk about euthanasia.
Get into something a little bit more controversial for part two.
Yeah, we can talk about MAID. Did you read any about MAID?
I did, yeah.
Medical assistance in dying in Canada.
Might be less controversial than you think. I might have to agree with you.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Because it's pretty fucked, right?
It's pretty fucked.
All right. But let's talk about the ancestry stuff and then we'll get to that. All right. See you on the other end.
So we're back for part two and it sounds like the construction workers have finished their lunch break. So we apologize for the buzzing.
Yeah.
Like quiet yelling that you hear in the background.
God, it's just everywhere now. Building, building, building.
Yeah, there's a lot of development happening in Bali.
Ugh, so sad. Another episode. Okay, so you wanted to talk about ancestors.
Yeah. I grew up in Hong Kong and Singapore, for people who don't know. And there's a very like big festival called the Hungry Ghost Festival. And it's at that time when you do, like, you go to the graves of your ancestors and you clean them up. You sweep and you like lay flowers and offerings and you burn like fake money and you burn, and at Chinese funerals, they often burn like paper effigies of stuff, like they'll burn like a paper house and they'll burn a paper car. And the idea is that you're sending up all those material belongings to your ancestors in the afterlife.
So you're dissolving all the worldly attachments and hopefully making it easier for that. Or, oh no, they're
no,
taking
you're
it
literally
with
them. Like sending them cash. Yeah. Really? You're like burning the cash so that they are like rich in there. Cause you wanna make sure your ancestors are happy, because that apparently really dictates your life in Eastern philosophy.
That's interesting. It's kind of contradictory though, because on one hand it's,
well, there's a difference between I think where Indians will go back and do ceremonies like on the anniversary, but they're usually very small. Like the Hungry Ghost Festival and the Chinese belief, it's like a big celebration and like feasting, and it's a time for the family to come together. So that's different. Like my grandfather passed away, and in India, my mom and my grandma recently went with my uncle to do the ceremony that you're supposed to do as the family of a deceased. But this is like a few years later. So there are, and then in Japan, there's like a very interesting custom where 7 days after the funeral, you go back, and then 7 weeks you go back, and then at 7 months you go back, and then at 7 years you go back, and then I think it's done.
Go back to the grave.
Do a prayer. So it's interesting that the mourning and the remembrance of your ancestors is a much more of a communal effort, I find, in the East than in the West.
Yeah, and there is this recognition that those ancestral spirits are still out there and they have some practical impact.
And
on
owe them something.
You do owe them something, yeah. Which makes sense. Yeah. I mean, we're all part of this ancestral chain.
Yeah.
Maybe not us because we don't have kids, but we're the last link in the chain.
For now.
For now, that's true.
I have a niece.
That's true. Yeah, awesome. So then from here, let's talk about the kind of modern views of death. And specifically, I want to talk about, I know you were reluctant to talk about this, but you said that we could talk about the MAID programs in Canada. Mm-hmm. So MAIDS, its acronym stands for Medical Assistance in Dying.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially state.
But I was reading that Canada has like pretty much the most liberal laws in the world for assisted. Because there's two things. There's euthanasia, which is like putting somebody out of suffering, is from what I understand, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's assisted suicide, which is giving somebody the permission to kill themselves with medical intervention.
Yeah, but there is a lot of overlap there.
And then there's like passive, which is where you take people off of life support.
Mm-hmm,
that can also be considered some kind of assisted death, you know?
Yeah,
so there's different categories, but basically Canada has said yes to all of them.
Yeah, right. Yes. Right. And then the idea of suffering is an important one because you're right that there is this more conservative idea of what euthanasia is, which is somebody has a terminal illness, they're very old,
in a lot of pain,
you just allow them, right? Yeah. You allow them to die. But I guess that's where me personally, I kind of draw the line. When you take an active role in expediting the death by actually putting some pharmaceutical product into somebody and killing them with that, that's just, oh.
I was reading the statistics in Canada and it said out of like 100% of applications, 81% of them are allowed.
And then, 81%.
Yeah.
And even in the cases.
And then it's like 4% are rejected. And then 13.5% of the people die before they can have the procedure.
By what means?
Like naturally.
They die naturally. Okay.
They die naturally before they can have the procedure. And then it said the average age of people going for assisted deaths is 76. Just to put things in a bit of perspective. I know it's maybe not what lines up with the laws at the moment, but it was interesting. I was like, 81%, that's a lot. And then, okay, 4%, only 4% rejection seems very little. And then this 13.5% or whatever of people who die naturally before they can have the assistance is just kind of, I guess it goes to show you the types of people that are applying for this
Well, it could
procedure.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a lot of different types of people. What I take issue with is they're opening it up to people that are homeless and have mental
disorders. I think disorders. Before the mental disorder thing is new. I think that one's so new, and that's why it's kind of come back into the news and been. It used to just be terminal illness or like
physical illness.
Yeah, illness or also like just general decline, which is I think their definition for like being old. Mm-hmm. But yes, when it starts to become about mental illness
and homelessness and too.
They fall into a similar category.
They do. But if somebody can point to that and say, well, this is the reason why. I mean, because like you said, they have to go through this application process. Mm-hmm. They have to submit their reasons for wanting to do it. Mm-hmm. And then they're either approved or not approved by the state. I didn't know that about the 81% being approved. It makes sense. To me, I don't want to get too political with this. To me, it seems to be a reflection of how that socialized medical system is struggling. Because mm-hmm. think about it from the government's perspective, instead of taking care of these people for another 5, 10, 15, 20 years, it's much cheaper and easier just to kill them. Mm. That sounds pretty brutal. And I don't think anybody would come out and say it directly, but that must play into this at some level in some way.
I mean, yeah, especially that age, I suppose. If your system's already struggling, you're at least giving people an option to exit your system.
Yeah, yeah.
What's interesting is that in Canada, you can only apply for this if you're a Canadian and you're eligible for the socialized healthcare system, actually.
Well, that,
and that, is,
that makes
and they,
sense.
And they wrote there that that's to prevent suicide tourism, which is actually a thing that happens like, so between 2008 and 2018, there was 1,250 German citizens who went to Switzerland to have this procedure done. Because in Switzerland, it's open to all nationalities.
Whoa.
And in Switzerland, the law is, it's a very gray area, but it's not illegal if you can prove that there was no motive. So if the person administering the drug had a motive to do it, like money, financial, whatever, then it would be considered illegal. If there is no motive and it's just out of compassion, it's not technically illegal. The other thing that they do is like, if you're, as long as like it's not the doctor, the one who presses the syringe, like it should be the person who's about to die to be the one to press the syringe, or like the doctor cannot feed the pill, needs to be the person who's going to die giving, self-administering.
Wow.
So it's very, I was reading about all the different laws in different countries of what's permissible and what's not. Japan kind of follows a similar path as Switzerland, but they also have these very aging populations where, I don't know. So interesting.
Whoa, that's a trip. So the doctor, just to get back to the Switzerland example, so the doctor can do everything to facilitate that process up until the point.
They can prepare the plate with the pill on it.
But they can't administer it.
They can, but that runs them in a risk of being in a gray area of,
as far as intent. I mean, it's so hard.
Of being at murder, basically.
Right. Yeah. Wow. I mean, in my mind, that if your whole practice or part of your medical practice is based off of that, I'm not going to go as far to say that you're complicit in murder, but in some cases.
I mean, in some places, that's the biggest, like, the thing that I think most people are concerned about is that if you create this freedom to self-suicide or assisted suicide, who is the biggest culprit, is who is the one who's actually doing the assisting,
right,
and can
that
person really be trusted?
Well, and what is their motive? I mean, if you look on the government side or all of it, that there is some motive to not, like we said, not have as many people in the system draining the resource out of the system. And there's also, if it is a for-profit enterprise and that's their business, then of course they're not going to turn away customers if that's how they make their money or part of their money. But to me, it comes.
But the criteria to be accepted is pretty vague.
It's pretty loose.
Yeah, it's pretty loose. And now, and they've said anybody over the age of 18 in Canada can apply for this if they fulfill. It's like four criteria. And they're not, it's, before it was like, they said that there was like a foreseeable chance they were going to die. It's like, well, everyone's gonna die.
So yeah, I think it's 100% certain that you're gonna die.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why it comes back to this question, which is how much suffering is acceptable?
Mm.
What level of suffering are you willing to accept in order to keep doing what you're doing or end your life?
Because yeah, and it's also what means are you taking to get out of the suffering? So I think part of the criteria or kind of the process that goes on before the assisted death is you have to be at least referred to a counselor. But it's not like you have to go for counseling. It's like the options need to be presented in front of you for you to take them, like alternative, like medicines or
don't you think that
or psychologists,
any,
but they're right. not mandatory.
And even if they were, don't you think that any good healer, whatever modality that they're using, would tell you that no, it's going to be okay. You have hope.
Yes, but the point is that these healers or the like spiritual practices are not mandatory in the lead up to this.
Mm-hmm.
They're just referrals.
Yeah, making it even more loose and a higher probability that you're able to get approved and able.
Because I was reading, I was like, okay, I wonder what Sadhguru has to say about suicide.
Yeah,
he's written a whole book about death, and he basically said like anybody who's contemplating suicide should just do yoga and like try to look at things in a more spiritual sense, and then you wouldn't, or you need to start educating people when they're younger about spirituality and start putting kids into yoga and giving them mindfulness practices. And he said, if any society is able to really integrate spiritual teachings, you would not find mm-hmm. as many suicides.
Mm-hmm. And that's my belief with it, that it's mm-hmm. like, if you're even at that point, for regardless of what reason, mm-hmm. if you're willing to take an active role in ending your own life, then something's gone amiss there.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think you know this, that my good friend Red, he committed suicide and he was early 40s. And looking at it from his perspective, if I were to be able to, I did talk to him. I talked to him 2 weeks before he died. Did I tell you this story? He was the boyfriend of my longtime girlfriend's sister, and the four of us. So it was Ruby and Red, and then me and Elizabeth. And the four of us were like a little family. Red didn't have a good connection with his family. His sister was, I hadn't talked to her in a long time. And that was his family, because Ruby mm-hmm. and Elizabeth had a very like solid family. And then Ruby and Red broke up and he went into this very deep depression, and it was fueled by drugs and alcohol. And in his mind, he had lost all hope. He had lost everything. His dad had died a few months prior to that. His adopted family was gone. And in his mind, that level of suffering was not acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
But, and then I saw him 2 weeks before he died. So Ruby calls me and says, Red is threatening to kill himself. He's got a noose. He says he has a noose hanging above his bed. And can you just go over there and check on him? Mm-hmm. So I go over there and check on him, and I go into his room, and sure enough, he's got a noose. He's because he had rafters kind of like this hanging above his bed. And sure enough, he had a noose hanging there. And mean, he's kind of this, he was like a punk rock dude, but he was also very conservative. It's the interesting thing about Red. He was like a Santa Cruz, San Jose punk rock glass blower, but hardcore conservative gun owner.
Mm.
So because of that, he wasn't really able to express his true emotions. He just mm-hmm. kind of like wrote it off. And I'm just kind of flabbergasted by it. Didn't really know how to respond. But my point in telling, and then 2 weeks later, I get the call from Elizabeth saying that he had committed suicide. And I remember being so angry at him mm-hmm. because, getting back to this question, what amount of suffering is acceptable?
Well, it's subjective, right?
It is.
Suffering is subjective.
And the thing is that I've been in that place where I felt like I can't go on anymore. But I'm so glad that I did. And I can't help but think, with somebody like Red that's made that choice, imagine it now. So this was 2015, so almost 10 years ago, 8 years ago, that if he were still here, how would he feel about that? What if that had gone another way?
But I think this is where we as the living hold on to an attachment, you asking yourself that question has nothing to do with Red.
Well,
anymore,
it doesn't anymore, but I hear you. And I take that point. But if I'm putting myself in his shoes and saying, well, what if? I know that the suffering was that bad at that point. And yes, I am biased.
Yeah, he probably could have come out of a deep dark hole and turned his life around. But
he didn't. So.
He didn't. Sadhguru's other part of that is, okay, so he says suicide is bad. And if somebody is being like, I want to commit suicide, you should tell them no. Mm-hmm. That's what he says. And he says you should guide them into looking at, you know, their life differently. And you should be against suicide. But he said after somebody has committed suicide, it's up to you as the living to release that, accept it, let go of it, you know? And I think that's where a lot of people have a hard time. And a lot of people I know who have had friends who've killed themselves have been angry and been like, that's so selfish of them. You know, they don't, you know, what were the people that they left behind, this and this and this. But in the end, that's not your weight to carry in a way as well. You know,
it's true.
And I think there is a difference between taking your own life and asking for your life to be taken. Also, like for me, self-performed suicide in some ways is almost more ethical because you're not involving the rest of the people. Yeah. You know, it might not be possible for people in their 80s and 90s to like physically do it to themselves, but I think if you're actually ready to kill yourself, it's a bit better than asking somebody else to do it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is a really interesting point, because I think that part of the reason that people feel more comfortable, because you're taking the opposite stance on it, which I like. It's interesting though, because I think a lot of people would take the opposite stance. I think I'm with you that at least you're not involving other people, but to medicalize it and to sanitize it in that way makes it seem like it's different than suicide.
That it's okay.
Yeah. Which maybe it's not. Maybe it's the same exact thing, but because you're involving a medical professional and they're administering this drug and it's very sanitized and it's to the point.
I mean, I will say there are some aspects of euthanasia that I do really admire. Like I kind of like the idea for very old people to have all their family in the room with them, you know, be able to time it, to go in a peaceful way when that's when you're not plagued by mental illness, or, you know, when it really is performed properly. Well, God knows what properly is, but when it's performed on people who are well into old age and who are using this as an opportunity to die in the best way possible, you know, without clinging on to everything, being able to have everyone holding them. I think there is some beauty in that. For people who are in a disgruntled state, we can use the bubble analogy again. For people who are in a disgruntled state with thick skin and small bubble, who are in a very narrow channel of like, this is my only escape, I think that's when it becomes maybe more dangerous or more unethical.
Well, and more karmic tension built up there too, because the bubble analogy is great, because when you have that tension, that karmic stuff that's built up, that it's going to have to come back. Mm-hmm. And by killing yourself, you're only delaying the inevitable, which is your soul, if you believe in reincarnation, that your soul's going to have to come back and relive that and learn those lessons. Yeah. But this, so getting to the idea of the form that it takes, because I agree with you that ideally the best way I think that anybody can imagine to die is being very old, surrounded by the people that you love, and just kind of slipping away peacefully. Mm-hmm. Now, you could make the argument, depending on what kind of drug that you're administering, that process is possible, but it's still accelerated. Mm-hmm. It's still an artificial input into the whole process that makes it happen quicker.
Sadhguru says that moment that you die is what matters. So like the thought and feeling that you're feeling in that moment when you die. So you can be like being ripped apart by an alligator, but if you're like, I lived a great life, you know, like it's time to go, that is a better death than somebody dying of natural old age, but angry that they didn't fulfill whatever they wanted to do in their life.
Yeah.
You know, so he's like that element of what mindset are you in when you actually go.
That makes sense.
Is really critical.
Yeah, I guess what I would say is that me taking this maximalist view on natural processes that I would say that you probably have a better chance of that happening if you've kind of succumbed to the idea that it's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And by inserting yourself artificially into the process, you haven't really let go of that. Yeah. You've just wanted to maintain some control over it.
Taking it easy.
Yeah, you're taking an easy option out and you're maintaining control over it and saying, well, this is when I want to die. This is how it's going to happen. And I mean, to be fair, maybe for some people that does allow them a certain peace.
Mm-hmm. And I think for a lot of people in their old age, it does. But I think if you're opening it up to people who are mentally ill, if you're opening this option up to people who are mentally ill or homeless, you're going to find, I think that at that moment of death, they are going to be clinging onto something.
I would think so too, because obviously they are. If there's that much pain and suffering, mm-hmm. then obviously they're clinging onto something in this life that they need to work through and they're going to have to work through anyway. Yeah.
Well, even looking back, like subjective, suffering is subjective. So maybe
it is unbearable.
Rest in peace, Red, that when he had that moment of passing, he was like, this is my release from, you know, and it maybe did come with sadness and sorrow, but let's pray that it actually, he went in a peaceful way, you know? And I think that was in his own hands and his own choice. And I think it's hard to say, and it's hard for, I think, a lot of people to come to terms with when somebody is commit suicide. But it's heavy. But I mean, what about when people die from an accident prematurely? Like that's also really hard for people to cope with, you know? So
it is. Yeah. And I agree with you. And that's kind of the perspective that I've taken on it over the years is that, and my dad said something similar. My dad had many people close to him commit suicide throughout his life. And he said that some people are just too sensitive for this world. And like you were saying, it was just so overwhelming. And that was his release. He did feel a sense of peace in that. The issue that I take with it, we've only got a few minutes left. The issue that I take with it is the way that he did it, to hang himself like that and to put it squarely on Ruby like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because
then you're leaving.
Yeah.
You're leaving the world with a lot of trauma. Yeah.
A lot of trauma. And poor Ruby, you know, she just carries that with her. I know that she does. And I know how hard, because he basically blamed it on her. Right. And that's like, that's so much shit to throw onto somebody.
Yeah.
But I hear you. I mean, I don't know. I kind of like, you kind of just let it go.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the best we can do, regardless of what precipitated the death and how whatever ritual or ceremony you engage
find
in
your,
after.
Find your way to honor it.
Yeah, find your way to honor it. Accept it, because what do they say? That there are only two certainties in life, death and taxes. So, yeah. Well, that...
some people would beg to differ.
I'm sure there are probably more than two. But yeah, I know the taxes thing.
Part of
I don't know. That's ways around that. So we got a couple minutes left. Anything you want to leave people with, Rish?
No, I highly recommend this book.
Yeah, Sad
Death.
Guru.
Really good. Different perspective, different cultural rituals. He also talks about his wife, actually, who he said was so spiritually connected that she was able to choose the moment of her death.
Oh, yeah. I remember you telling me this.
Super fascinating. We can leave it after this. Like, she was like preparing. Once she heard that it was possible to basically spontaneously leave your soul, to leave your body, she just started learning, like, I want to do that. And they had like a small daughter, and she was like, no, like, I've fulfilled my purpose. This is it. I want to go in this way. And then he basically said, like, one day during a meditation, she just like slumped over and died.
Oh my God. How, sorry.
And she was like a young and healthy person.
Okay. Yeah. So why though?
Because, and it was, she left.
They had a young daughter.
But she explained it to her daughter. She said, look, I'm going to be going.
Was she suffering?
Nope. She was like, I need to go now because this is the happiest I'm ever going to be.
Whoa.
Kind of. I don't know. Interesting way.
That is interesting.
I highly recommend the book. There's loads of weird stories and stuff like that about death. And And I will say that not all Indians are cremated. They do say that if you're very, very, very old, or like a lot of gurus and stuff are buried because they don't have this residual death energy. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. Maybe just give some people some food for thought about, you know, their inevitable future.
Thank you very much, Rishi. You're a wealth of knowledge on this topic.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this one.
I don't even want to say, you know, the dream I had.
Yeah.
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 I had a dream that Rishi died, and then I was talking to your mother, and like I was distraught. You know those dreams you have where you like feel it, and you're like, and then you appeared behind me. But then I was like, then I told myself, and I told Gaiti that Gaiti is Rishi's mom. I was like, well, it's not real. Like I know that she. It was like I was accepting you to leave. I think it's partly because you left for Europe, and then we had the disagreement. I was like, Rishi doesn't want to do the show with me anymore. She's probably. You should see your face on the video of the artificial intelligence one, because it was right after we recorded the propaganda.
Oh, I know,
one.
I saw it.
And you're like,
oh. If anyone wants to see my angry face, we have a YouTube.
So good.
Please subscribe.
So, anyway, I think it was more metaphorical. Like I thought I was going to lose you as a friend and as a co-host.
Nope, so I don't still think, here.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That speaks a lot to your character and your commitment to the show. So anyway, yeah, thank you, Rishi. And thank you guys for listening and watching. Definitely like us, subscribe, follow, all that stuff. I don't know what platform you're on. And also, we should definitely say this, that if you are experiencing those feelings about wanting to harm yourself, please, first of all, don't. It's going to be okay. And talk to someone, whoever that someone is, spiritual leader, medical professional, your friends, your family. And we will leave it at that.
Thanks.
See you next time.